and welcome to another episode of Radio War Nerd. The date today is April 16th, 2026, and this is episode 599. I am the co-host Mark Ames in Western New York, the Empire State. You are listening to Radio War Nerd. Subscribe, please go to patreon.com/Radio War Nerd, one word, and support the show. Okay, and I'm on the line, of course, with the War Nerd, John Dolan, a.k.a. Gary Brecher, not in southern Italy. Now you moved on up north. Where are you guys right now?
Yeah, we're in Turin, where we used to live. But we're here to meet some old friends. And we're also going to get my brain checked out, some would say years overdue, by a neurologist who's probably going to, I don't know, ask me who's president, who's vice president. Yes. And it's like, come on, not that.
You could do the Trump thing when they test him and go, the doctor said no one has ever passed so well before. No one has ever been better than John Dolan.
Yeah, I could do that. They show me a picture. I say, tiger, elephant, kitty cat. I don't know. And I said it faster than anybody else ever did.
But the doctor couldn't believe it.
I just hope she won't be too scathing in her views. Like, I just imagine her going through the test and then saying, well, and then shaking her head and saying, it's amazing you got this far. I don't know how you managed to do that. You've clearly developed an ability to bluff.
I think you'll be fine. But let's get to happier stuff, wars.
Yeah.
I don't know.
And like, triumphal arches.
Yes. Yeah, I think we have to start off this episode of World of Wars with the Arc de Triomphe. And I mean, just the levels of absurdity here. I have to say some things, I don't know about you, John, but in so many ways, so much of what's going on just reminds me so much of the Bush W years during the Iraq War.
Yeah.
The can you believe this stupidity? It's what created material for John Stewart and launched, you know, that whole world of political humor, because the Bush administration was so fucking ridiculous, evil and ridiculous at the same time. And it's just
To think of what a remake of In the Loop would look like with Trump, and it wouldn't work, I don't think.
No.
I mean, it would have to be a very different kind of bitter comedy. And the jokes are not just the lead up to wars, but the lead up, the follow up, and the massive destruction that goes on in this country, or in the U.S., rather.
That's a really good point, because also the Bush people were, and it's incredible to say this because this doesn't include W himself, but they were a lot more articulate. So what was funny about In the Loop were all of the absurd compromises that people who might otherwise have, you know, they might have been bad people, but they kind of knew a bit more about what was really going on, but were all about pursuing their careers and so, you know, keeping these fictions going. And like the James Gandolfi, whatever the hell his name is, character. Whereas the Bush people are as a matter
the
of
Trump
principle.
People.
Yeah, I'm sorry. The Trump people, as a matter of principle, are stupid, you know, evil, badass meatheads, like as a matter of principle.
Yeah, and I mean, so I really have doubts. I have doubts about how much is stupid and how much is evil. And I think it's time to consider the possibility that the hardcore Trump troops, like his immigration czar, his other cadre, really hate the United States. I mean, they act like that sometimes in a way that's hard to mistake for stupidity, or at least any kind of stupidity that I've seen. I mean, yeah, the kind of 4th of July, wave the flag stupidity. Hegseth is at least a good imitation of that. But a lot of Trump people don't seem to go for that. It's as if they found it as unaesthetic as most Berkeley people would. They just go direct for what will do harm.
Yeah, that's a really good point. So, because I think, you know, they know it's not like in Nixon's time, for example, or Reagan's time, there was a sense that there was this completely unserviced and sullen and enraged silent majority that didn't have the energy of this, of basically baby boomers that everyone resented. And so you could say, well, a real America, as they called it, you know, was this large, ignored or despised, whatever, demographic. The Trump people kind of, they know they're a minority. They like being a minority.
Yeah.
And want vengeance on this country.
That's really true. I mean, I've been reading letters from Vietnam, and some of them are quite insane. Like, you know, literally, if we don't fight the Viet Cong now, they'll be in San Diego tomorrow. And you wonder how any of these people could have believed it, but they did. They were mostly pretty young and pretty stupid. They stuck with that. But I don't think anybody believed that the Iraq War, at least after it was over, was a great thing. But they liked the fact that it hurt their enemies, and that stayed with them. And even after every election that Trump has won, you see a lot of this sort of vindictiveness. Like, I don't care. I don't care. Mm-hmm. It makes liberals cry.
It's
Oh God.
It's as you would say. It's bombing that neighbor down the street's house, even if it blows out half of my house. It's that's its own reward. Tell us about the victory arch. I don't know his Arc de Triomphe. Like what the? Well, let's talk about it for a second because this captures the absurdity of this. Like especially since it's gone. I mean, it's sort of moved into the papers. They're pushing it now, right after the kind of the most rapid and the most rapid, like, strategic defeat the U.S. military, the U.S. empire has ever suffered, as far as I can tell. I mean, I guess there might be more rounds to this, but certainly after round one, I've never seen anything like this. And then he proposes this big Arc de Triomphe.
Yeah, I mean, I think the most important thing about the first triumphal arch that most people are familiar with was the one that was built after the Battle of Austerlitz during the Napoleonic Wars. Mm-hmm. And that was a genuine triumph. I mean, a magnificent victory. The French destroyed, three armies destroyed a continent-wide alliance of powers that outnumbered them heavily. And they took prisoner more than 100,000 enemy troops. And they also, in a move that's been winning battles ever since Cannae, in the Roman-Carthaginian Wars, where something like 70,000 Romans were just slaughtered on the field. And you had to do that by hand in those days. You had to, that's one, that's two, that's, oh, God, this guy's tough. All right, that's their second cut, that's three. That's a lot of killing. And the technique is to sort of draw the enemy into what seems like a victory, depending on the topography, and then move in and with a crushing force, in Napoleon's case, a lot of artillery, a lot more troops, then just wipe them out. And wipe them out in large part because, especially in terms of the Austrian troops, as Hemingway says in his novel about World War I, A Farewell to Arms, he portrays the German army as rather terrifying, but the Austrian army as tedious, just in the way. And that stereotype has carried over for quite a while, but the Russian army, the German army, and various other armies of German principalities were destroyed in the Battle of Austerlitz. No matter what you think of Napoleonic France as a political entity, it was a genuine triumph. And the first question that comes to mind to me after that, well, the first question is actually, oh, yeah, remember when we were in Vientiane, the capital of Laos?
And, oh, yeah, Vientiane, yeah.
And I thought there was film in my camera. And I took all these photos that could have gotten me killed of, like, gamblers on a Mekong river boat.
Yes.
And there was no film in the camera. And there was no film in the camera when I did all these detailed studies of the Arc de Triomphe that's in Vientiane. And so as a result, I had no photographs of that. it was a shining moment in photojournalism, so who am I to talk? But anyway, so that's the Arc de Triomphe in France. I mean, there's also one right down the street from NYU or...
Oh, yeah, you're right. Yeah, it is near NYU. There is some kind of arch there of some sort. Yeah. Yeah, what's that
but,
one? Do you know?
I don't quite know what it commemorates because the central thing about this one is it's not going to commemorate anything except, I suppose, Trump, which I suppose is what Trump meant originally. And it's going to be the rival of the Lincoln monument, which apparently is across the river. And I can see that Lincoln would prey on Trump's conscience a little, this depressive, sad, just generally sad person with a sense that he was going to be doomed, as opposed to Trump, who wouldn't deign to shake God's hand if he ever does make it up there. But anyway, there is no recent victory in American arms. What is the victory? What are we celebrating?
And so it it says here that it's a 250-foot triumphal arch to mark 250 years, because this is the 250th year since the Declaration of Independence. And so we're considered independent since 1776. So that's what it's for. So basically a triumph over the British, which Trump actually might like, since he doesn't like Keir Starmer. Starmer waffled. I mean, Starmer does pick up Trump's papers on the ground. Like, no matter how dirty they are, he'll scramble around for whatever Trump drops. But he's
actually
sort of
waffled. That's a consolation. Like, well, we may have to deal with Trump, but at least we don't have to deal with Starmer being in charge of us. But yeah, I mean, Trump supposedly said about other triumphal arches, the only thing they have is history. It's like, okay.
God. Yeah, there's one in Moscow too, a big one. And that one was, it's in Moscow, I mean. And that was built... I think they even rebuilt it, but it was initially built to celebrate the victory over Napoleon. So it's kind of, they took Napoleon's design which is the Roman design originally, which to celebrate, the victory over Napoleon. But I feel like it's now kind of conflated, or maybe part of, this may have happened after I left, also victory over the Nazis in World War II.
Those are the two great victories in Russian history, recent Russian history. But I can't see any recent victory since 1945 that the U.S. would be celebrating.
Granada.
Which is kind of... Oh, yeah. I don't think anybody has said that yet about this one.
Yes.
But they will eventually.
Yeah.
And that will be an even more depressing moment. But the real thing is it's celebrating Trump, I would mm-hmm. assume. And
yeah.
So it's going to be 250 feet high. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be oddly insectoid. Like when Trump was by that guy's bedside, there was an insectoid kind of locust-like figure at the top of the image. And there's one on the arch as well. I've just looked at models of the design. And maybe Trump will crawl out of his human chrysalis like the little bug at
Or I was going to say
Team
Men
America.
In Black. Right, in Team America, yeah. Right. Or Men in Black crawling out of... you remember when the bug wears Vince D'Onofrio's skin. Oh, you want me to put my hands above my head?
yeah. At least D'Onofrio was funny about it.
He was great, D'Onofrio's always good. Funny character actor, yeah. So let's talk about... let's talk about some wars. I don't know, maybe just as a quick, as a transition here. I don't know if you saw, but, well, this was first reported in Zitteo. It's kind of a new media Substacky kind of site, I guess you call it, that there are, Trump is basically moving forward with plans to invade Cuba and do a hard regime change there. And then USA Today followed up on it and wrote basically the same thing, but kind of confirmed it through their sources. And to me, it just smacks of Granada, because that's why I brought up Granada. Like, you lose to the Iranian allies as Reagan did in Lebanon when Islamic Jihad, or maybe it was Hezbollah, you know, there were clearly links to Iran. When they blew up the Marine barracks there, they should never have been sitting ducks in a Marine barracks in the middle of Beirut.
No,
in the first
a
place.
High-rise barracks is kind of a dumb idea.
Incredibly dumb, yeah. And especially, it wasn't the first bombing, so they should have known. But that killed 241 U.S. Marines, still the worst single-day death toll for U.S. Marines, I believe, since World War II. And so 2 days later, Reagan invaded Granada to try to get, you know, that's what the U.S. empire does. Something bad happens, goes wrong for the empire farther away, and so you go back and smash, bully somebody closer to home that you can more easily bully and smash.
But I want to emphasize that Tip O'Neill, who was playing the old Democratic middle of the road, we're all patriots here, stupid, self-destructive game at the head of the Democratic Party, forbade anyone in the Democratic caucus or whatever to try to make any political hay out of that debacle. And it damn well should have been made into political hay.
Absolutely.
But they were very... touchingly patriotic, naively patriotic, and they didn't say a thing about it. And then when Reagan and his people, who were really kind of psychotic and vengeful, I know because I used to sort of lean that way, they never hesitated about trying to capitalize on their enemies' weaknesses. They just went at it, and nobody in the Democratic Party ranks even seemed to notice this. They just kept trying to be patriotic. I mean, even today, the Democratic leadership, well, there are other reasons, like Schumer's loyalty to Israel. Yeah. But it's basically the same game. Like, we're all in this together, guys. Let's all pull for the U.S. team. So let's not do anything that might cause Trump trouble. To the point that today there was a demonstration outside of Schumer's headquarters. With Chelsea Manning and a few other celebrities. Bernie Sanders is the only one opposing it. And Bernie Sanders, as the Democratic Party always says, is not a real Democrat. Like, okay, why would he want to be?
Yeah. Yeah, they there was a vote yesterday that it's getting a lot of chatter here in the Senate to block some arms sales to Israel, to block bulldozers to the IDF, which we all know what they're used for, a key instrument in the ethnic cleansing, and then also to block so-called dumb bombs. Like they're starting with the more obvious weapons, I guess. But it's and they did get roughly 40 Democratic senators.
That is impressive. That's good.
It's impressive. It's like I'm of two minds here because it's sort of like, well, the thing is about 90% of the base is for this. And, you know, so 40 out of, 47, 48 senators voted for it. Okay, that's making some progress. Of course, John Fetterman, the loon ball in the hoodie, is for, he hates Democrats. There's nothing worse than a convert. He hates Democrats and peace and anybody who's against.
Well, he's the second one. The first that loon from Arizona, right?
Sinema. There was Sinema there.
But Kirsten or whatever.
But I'm not sure she's loony. She's just evil. And Fetterman, I think, actually has a major screw loose. I mean, everybody knows it. He's admitted. I think he's written about it. You're supposed to feel sorry for him as he pushes harder for genocide. It's like, oh, but think about his troubles. You know, he's
in troubles. When you come to think about it, I had a brain injury. I should go out and start doing felonies.
Yes. But John Fetterman, you know, he said. So there were nine Democrats who voted with the Republicans to not block this sale of these weapons, including Chuck Schumer, of course. Kirsten Gillibrand, the other New York senator. They're both awful.
What is she like? I don't know anything about New York.
It's funny. Okay. I remember, so during Trump 1, she kind of held herself up as kind of Bernie curious. I mean, it was so obviously phony. Bernie curious, but using the Me Too very cynically to try to promote herself and really promote the neoliberal wing of the party. Leaning heavily on sort of, you know, identity politics. And you know, that's like Sinema. She initially, I think, ran for president in the 2019-20 primaries. And she was part of the effort, which was really to split the progressive wing or the leftish wing of the Democratic Party, to split up the base in order to great room for Biden to move in and take it. Mm. She was part of that, just like Kamala Harris.
Yeah, you do have to imagine sometimes, like, suppose they hadn't done that. Suppose they'd cast their lot with the progressives. I mean, the Democratic Party would have come to power really easily, I think, the first time Bernie ran. And they would still be in power, and it's kind of sad to think of that.
Yeah, well, they very consciously do not mobilize the base precisely because of that, because the donors don't like it, and the donors come first. The donors and the empire come first, and the base is something that you yank around, make promises to.
Right.
Once in a while, you lose to the base, like what's happening in Michigan right now, too. I mean, we've talked about Graham Plattner, who is going to sweep, it looks like, you know, the main Senate, both the primary against the establishment candidate and then against Susan Collins, the Republican. And not just in spite of, but almost because he has a Nazi tattoo and he is, you know, pro-Palestine against the Israel genocide. And he's been very consistent on it going back to high school. You know, he's a strange dude, but the strangeness of him and his kind of dark checkered past with Blackwater, it all, it's the opposite of the kind of the perfect, you know, Tracy Flick sort of background where you've never made a mistake in your life. And it really counts for something now. And so in the Michigan primary for the Democratic Party for Senate, there's a Senate vote. There's sort of two establishment candidates, two party establishment candidates. And then there's Arab Muslim, you know, has a large Arab and Muslim community outside of Detroit and elsewhere in Michigan. And so the progressive, the Bernie-backed candidate, Abdul Al-Sayed, he was polling in third, but had a lot of energy. And he was starting to kind of, he kept kind of slowly moving up. So that's when the party establishment, including the former CIA goon, Senator Slotkin, they all came down somewhat on Al-Sayed, but really on Hassan Piker. And we've talked about this in previous episodes because Al-Sayed had campaigned with Piker and gone on Piker's show. They accused Piker of anti-Semitism and Al-Sayed of siding with anti-Semitism and really went hard. I mean, this was literally in the middle of the war. The Democrats spent 2 weeks in the middle of the war that they really didn't want to talk about, going after Hassan Piker and by extension, Abdul Al-Sayed. And what's happened? They just released a poll today. Al-Sayed's moved into first place.
Wow.
And it's because everybody fucking hates the Democratic Party establishment, and really the Democratic Party, but you have no choice. So it's just the establishment. And if you run against the establishment or you are targeted by them, and you're targeted as an anti-Semite, nobody believes that anymore. And there's real anti-Semitism, and it's tough shit. No one believes it anymore, the real and the fake, because it's been abused. That slur has been abused so much that it just doesn't have... It used to be an absolute career killer. Your face and name would never be seen again. And it's kind of now a mark of, wow, he must be authentic. You know, he must be real. He or she is not one of those kind of fake candidates pretending to be of the left, pretending to be against the establishment, but has actually taken a hit that we can see. And so, you know, that's what's happening. And I hope Al-Sayed wins. I mean, you know, I don't ever expect anything from the Democratic Party, but anytime the establishment takes hits and gets bled is a good thing, period.
Yeah, I mean, I keep thinking, parties have died before in American history, but every time I talk to people much more learned in U.S. history than I am, they say it's almost impossible.
Yeah, unfortunately it is. Yeah, it's structurally almost impossible, unfortunately. The friend of the show, Michael Pollack, had shared with me this big... Can't remember if it was in Jacobin or written by a Jacobin writer. I think it was Seth Ackerman, but a really great kind of deep dive analysis into how authoritarian the U.S. electoral system is, how we're locked into two parties, and how the whole system is structured to make it all but impossible for a third party to ever get anywhere. So your only choice really is to try to take over one of the parties. It's very, very, very hard. And it informs kind of the left's electoral strategy, which, you know, has very little chance, but has had some wins, you know, winning. I mean, Mamdani's win is a pretty big deal in New York City. It's probably the biggest deal, and certainly since Bernie's.
Yeah. Every day I read the New York Post's effort to undo that victory. It's like they're going to keep trying no matter how many terms he serves. It's like Mamdani, I don't know. It is a new scandal every day, or pseudo scandal.
Yeah, and he's good for them. And the Post, I mean, one thing about the Post, they're so great in their headlines. They really do make good headlines. Whether you're with them or against them, it's the game that counts, John. Right. Yeah. So let's move on a little bit to the main war, the U.S. Israel war on Iran and Lebanon. The hot part of this war is happening in Lebanon still, but I don't know, something might change between us talking and posting the show, but apparently, like, there's a lot of ceasefire talk going on, and Iran is demanding a ceasefire there, and they're right. I mean, that was part of the initial deal, ceasefire deal or cessation of hostilities, ceasefire deal with Trump, was that Israel would cease hostilities against Hezbollah and Lebanon. And of course, Israel instead went on this incredible massacre. But since then, Israel's doing its usual thing, which is incredible violence, but possibly agreeing to some kind of very bitter ceasefire. And there is talk that there might be a ceasefire by tonight. So, I don't know.
Pakistan is apparently playing a big role in that. And I want to mention that I'm kind of pleased with the listener response to our guest whom you found.
It was with help from our friend of the show, Cyrus, by the way. Big shout out to Cyrus. Yeah.
She was really, really good, and a lot of people really appreciated it.
Yeah. Yeah, that was great because we got more of we have been very critical of Pakistan, and they just, not that they don't deserve all of it, they have, but it was a great way to understand Pakistan dynamics more from the Pakistani point of view, like to get to understand their own thinking, their own ways, and why they're, the structure of the government, the structure of rule, what they perceive as their interests and so on. That was a real eye opener for me, I think.
It really was. I mean, she was particularly illuminating. And also I wanted to mention that the name I could not remember was Gul, General. General, I think, Ahmed Gul.
The ISI chief? It was the army chief. Yeah. Right. So one of the things that kind of stands out to me about Israel's war on southern Lebanon and all of Lebanon, but particularly its moves to flatten Lebanon between the Israeli border and the Litani River or further north of there and depopulate it. I mean, they're very open about depopulating it. It's just, I don't know if you've seen some of these New York Times reports, like the New York Times will write about how Israel's policy is to ensure that no ethnic Shia live in this area and that Christians and Sunnis are being, either encouraged or killed to make sure that this policy happens. But they won't use the word ethnic cleansing. It's just so strange. And they use the word, buffer zone. I just can't imagine if them using the word, Russia is creating a buffer zone in Donbass. Like, they're attempting to create a buffer zone. Yeah, anyway.
As far as I know, no one has managed to make the NYT or people who share its sensibility even flinch about comparisons between coverage of the war in Ukraine and the one in the Middle East.
No, I think it annoys them. I'm sure, actually, it annoys them when they get called out. But they have a policy. And it is, if you're going to do state propaganda, it's the smartest policy to pretend like they don't see it. But I know that it annoys them. I'm absolutely sure of it. You can see it in sort of different...
Well, that's something.
Some people should keep annoying them. It does. Yeah. One other point I want to make is that Israel sort of in pockets of this incursion into southern Lebanon, it's been a month and a half since they first launched the ground invasion, and they're still fighting a mile or two from the border in parts where Hezbollah has kind of decided to fight harder and you know, really put up a fight. The IDF has not been able to secure, you know, towns there. And sometimes they'll secure a town, or they'll announce that they've secured a town, and the next thing they know, like, a house has been blown up with a bunch of IDF soldiers in it, or they have to re-cleanse it again. They're not securing this land, so I don't think the ground war is going too well for them.
No, it's clear, I think, that it is not, but it's hard to get any consistent coverage in any news site that I've seen. Al Jazeera is oddly bland about most of this. Like, they want to emphasize, and reasonably enough, they want to emphasize how much pain is being brought to the Lebanese population. But, I mean, they're not particularly pro-Shia themselves either.
Exactly. That's exactly it. Yes. Yeah. They're not pro-Shia, so they're being careful how they frame this. They don't want their audience to think that the Shia are resisting successfully. It makes them nervous, you know, and so they kind of downplay that. But particularly, like, the battle for Bint Jebel, which is, again, it's like between a mile and two from the border. That's where I think Israel had its big problems in 2006. They've been very vengeful in that town, and they're still fighting there. They're still fighting there. And so, you know, Israel might want themselves at this point a ceasefire, and I think certainly Trump does. I mean, the deal that Trump made initially, which was a complete capitulation to get out of a sort of a corner he'd boxed himself into, the deal he made with Iran included Israel's ceasing hostilities against Hezbollah. And of course, he went back on that, as the Americans often do, as the Israelis do, the next day. But the Pakistani mediator said, no, this was part of the deal. So we have this going on. This might lead to a cease. I mean, I can't, you know, the ceasefire between the U.S. particularly and Iran is very tenuous, very fragile, made more so by Trump's announcement of this blockade, which is both absurd and also not absurd. Absurd, of course, because Iran's weapon is basically blockading the Strait of Hormuz, and Trump's blockading of the blockade is meant to cause Iran economic pain by not allowing it to sell oil, because Iran, most of the oil that has been sold that went through the Strait of Hormuz since February 28th, most of that has been Iranian. Iran has let through a few other tankers from a few other countries, but most of it's been Iranian. And for a while, the U.S. had a policy of allowing Iran to sell the oil because the U.S. has been afraid of oil prices rising even higher than they already have risen. Now we've imposed a blockade to try to strangle Iran. To me, it's nonsensical, because it would take at least a couple of months for this to really affect Iran, because Iran already has, like, its tankers are all over the world now selling their oil. Their own storage facilities for oil were practically empty when this U.S. blockade started, because Iran really made sure to sell all of its oil. So that means that Iran could keep pumping oil and keep all of that going for, as I've read, at least maybe 6 weeks, maybe 2 months. We don't really know. One thing we've done, the U.S., the West, whatever, one thing we've done this entire war is completely underestimate Iran. This goes back to Saddam Hussein in the 1980s, underestimating Iran, you know.
I mean, there was a pretty decent series in the NYT on Trump's decision to go to war with Iran. And basically everybody with any sense in his administration told him, don't do this. And then, but Trump, I mean, it's a very obvious fatal characteristic, just like in all the old Irish stories, the hero always has a fatal gish or taboo. And like, you know, Colin has this taboo that he can't pass any cooking fire without taking something from it. And he can't eat the meat of a dog. And slowly, slowly, their minds begin to work. And eventually, after a few eons, they say, hey, why don't we put a dog feast in front of his cabin or whatever? But Trump has this glaringly obvious fault, like a million times more obvious than Collins, which is that you can flatter him. If you're shameless enough, you can twist him around your little finger. And so Netanyahu and his team, probably a bunch of talk show hosts, like, you're a great guy, Mr. Trump, went to work on him. And everybody else in the room, even on his side, was
except
saying,
Hexeth.
Please don't do this.
Except yeah. Hexeth, yeah.
Yeah,
speaking
that's
of talk
true,
show
eh?
hosts, you know.
Yeah. That's true. He was literally in that business. Mm-hmm. Everyone else said, please don't do this. And Trump said, I just got a feeling in my bones. It's incredible.
Yeah, I also think a kind of subset of that flaw is telling him it can't be done or that there are problems, that that basically you need everything to go right. Is almost like a red flag to a post. I don't know. It's like a gambling addict, you know, being shown that actually, like a gambling addict thinking, I just feel lucky. Like, you know, I know I shouldn't.
Yep.
I know you're not. And normally, but he who doesn't gamble doesn't drink champagne. And, you know, I think that's another flaw. And you could kind of work it that way. So you have the cautious people saying, well, this could go badly. We have this problem. They might close the Strait of Hormuz. And all you need is one convincing flatterer to say, no, you can do it differently. You're not afraid to do it. With you, it actually can go well.
Right.
And what's happening here, so this, first of all, a blockade is an act of war. And so it's kind of a funny way to have a ceasefire when you introduce a new weapon of war. Now, in the popular mind, and the popular mind does matter, things like economic sanctions or blockades even are kind of viewed as more, economic sanctions more soft weaponry, even though it has very devastating hard effects, including death, you know, and disease, but it's not considered an actual hard use of weaponry. Now, blockade, a real military blockade, that's kind of a different story. That involves hard weaponry. And I've been trying to get a sense of how this blockade, so there, first of all, there's just so much bullshit going on right now. Like there are stories about U.S. destroyers, you know, traversing the Strait of Hormuz, you know, U.S. destroyers all around the Persian Gulf. It's really hard to get a sense of where the U.S. Navy is, where they are interdicting. They are, as far as I know, they're, you know, basically communicating with tankers and telling them to turn back, and some tankers are turning back. Now, it has been reported, actually, just before we went on, it was reported in a pretty reliable sort of online site, Tanker Trackers, that Iran has been able to ship 11 million barrels of crude since this, you know, supposed blockade a few days ago was imposed. And that may be the case. I mean, I think I feel like the blockade is both kind of a PR demonstration, and it's meant to cause problems for Iran, but they don't want to go all the way because, again, that could send oil prices skyrocketing even more. So it's kind of a semi-blockade that's announced as a full blockade. But I've been trying to understand where the U.S. ships are that are blockading them and asking around, And it's been very hard. Like, my guess is this. The Iranians know exactly where every U.S. ship is. Because, as we've been saying pretty much since the beginning of the war, and now it's confirmed from the FT and other outlets, the Chinese are giving Iran really high-resolution, great satellite intelligence, among other things. I'm sure they're getting other intelligence in other ways, but we know that. So the Iranians know where the ships are. The U.S., of course, presumably knows where their own ships are. We don't know where they are, so that's where the ambiguity is.
Yeah, can I stress that point? Because that's been a real feature of this war, the fact that there was a stage 20 years ago where maybe high-tech intelligence wasn't that great, but the bulk of it got shared, as far as I know. And there is no pretense of that. The U.S. elite is openly saying this is a need-to-know information age, and you don't need to know that. Yeah. They've been quite open about that.
Yeah, well, one thing they openly did was they clamped down on all the American and or Western, I don't know, satellite companies that have been providing open source satellite information to all the OSINT bros, all the, you know, open source analysts, experts, and so on. And they just, they shut it down a week or two into the war. And it wasn't, again, because the Iranians were using that. It was because we could see how much damage the Iranians were causing on all these THAAD missile interceptor radars and air bases and so on. I mean, this is something, again, we have to emphasize in this war that's incredible. Like, today, the last of the U.S. military forces that have been stationed in Syria since Obama, I think, first went after ISIS, as that was the pretext, the last ones just left. They left through Jordan because Iraq isn't friendly anymore. Speaking of Iraq, as far as I know, all U.S. forces have also had to leave Iraq. Most of the bases, like in Kuwait, Bahrain, other areas, have been depopulated of American service people. I mean, there's been a mass depopulation of U.S. bases in the Persian Gulf because of this war. This is a huge deal.
And some of them were evacuated in a particularly humiliating fashion, like piecemeal by renting rooms in hotels so that the soldiers could be dispersed at a probably prohibitive rate, but they wouldn't be concentrated on bases where they could be easily hit. It's such childish lack of preparation. Really extraordinary.
Yeah. And it says to these countries, and, you know, this gets into the diplomacy side, but it says to all of these GCC countries that the U.S. can't protect them, and that B, the U.S. and Israel, which are basically interlocked, are a threat because they can't be controlled and they can't be relied on to do things with a view to how this might affect the GCC countries. That the U.S. and Israel...
No, it's clear the GCC is second rank priority. I mean, Israel and U.S. Garrisons are first rank. I'm not sure in which order, but they are. And GCC, well, you know, war is tough.
Yeah, war is tough. And pledge $1 trillion to my Trump, whatever the hell it is.
That's the other thing. I just wanted to say, nobody seems to invoke the 1980s very much because nobody remembers anything. But Iran was at war throughout the 1980s, and they were at war with Iraq, which was heavily favored U.S. Satellite, as in, we hate you, but we hate Iran much more. So we're going to give you all our satellite info, and we're going to give you certain key parts of key weapons. Iran was boycotted and embargoed all through that decade in varying ways.
Much more so than now. I mean, now they have China and Russia backing them. So that's a really important thing to keep in mind. They were backed by Iraq. Iraq was backed by everybody, including Russia, the USSR. And Iran had nobody except Israel the first couple of years until Israel realized that what was going on in Iran was for real. But Israel was more worried about Iraq at the time. So,
Yeah, and they lasted. I mean, they have an incredible capacity to endure. And they ended up winning, and Saddam begged them for peace and didn't really get it at first until he begged them a second time and offered bigger compromises. But I hate to invoke this cliche, but, you know, as Terrence McSweeney said while he was starving to death, victory will go to those not who can inflict the most, but to those who can endure the most. Mm-hmm. And in Iranian recent wars, that seems to be true. It's not always true, but it seems to be in that area and in those wars.
Yeah, I mean, to that point, the Saddam, when he first invaded, thought it was going to be a 2 or 3 week thing. I mean, these echoes, they never, you know, I was going back and reading on some of this. He was sure it was going to be a two or three week operation. He was sure because of protest, you know, and that the IRI at the time had not really consolidated power so well, that the regime was not particularly popular. And it wasn't popular with large swaths of the population.
Right.
And so he thought the regime is weak, fractured, just like Trump thought, because of the protest that, you know, Israel and the U.S. helped to engineer, and, you know, and the fact they've been in a long time and so on. Like, they make the same, you know, mistake. And one of the things that's so interesting about Iran's response, I mean, Iran wound up fighting, you know, Iran was initially kind of, you know, shocked and surprised, but that shock did not awe them, that mobilized them, that organized them. And one of the things reading again back about sort of testimony, both from like young sort of, you know, teenagers who were brought in for some of those Basij human waves, but who survived it and then were captured as POWs, or interviews with pilots. The pilots for the Iranian Air Force were, a lot of them were in jail because Air Force officers tend to be reactionary, you know, and so if you have a revolutionary government, they're usually not your friends, and a lot of these guys were in jail until the war started. And all of them were saying, even some of these kids were like, I'm not really for the government, I'm not a religious zealot myself, or I don't know, I'm not really ideological, but my country is invaded, and so I'm going to back my country. And like, what the hell do you expect? I mean, I was reading this article in USA Today about Trump's plans to invade Cuba, and the USA Today interviewed this guy Brian Fonseca, director of the Jack D. Gordon Institute for Public Policy at Florida International University, and he's studied Cuba's military extensively. And the quote here is, "With Cuba's military equipment in deteriorated condition and its officers unlikely to adhere to an unpopular regime, a U.S. military operation in Cuba would likely be a fast, overwhelming success. Quote, this will be a very easy military victory, unquote, but a far more difficult political victory." Maybe, but I'm not sure about that, you know? I'm really not sure about that.
He should have to put his life on the line after that prediction.
Yes.
If you're right, we'll make you a billionaire. If you're wrong, it will not go well with you.
Yeah, Braveheart at the end.
Because though nobody seems to remember it anymore, the only troops who fought really well in Grenada were a Cuban construction brigade. They put down their construction tools and heavy equipment, took up AK-47s, and fought very hard. And there was a construction brigade of Cubans even in Venezuela, and they were just about the only unit of the Venezuelan armed forces who fought well against the invading U.S. and other forces. So I really, really doubt that you're going to get a casualty-free operation against even a heavily depleted, outnumbered force of Cubans because they fight really well.
They do fight really well. That's absolutely true. And there's a history of that. I mean, yeah. We covered a bit of that in the episode with the blowback guys on the Angola wars. And we've talked about, I think, in the Ethiopia war as well.
Yeah.
There's a history of that, and there's pride in that. And God, it's just it is so believable that Trump would compound one failure with another, all because he got lucky in Venezuela.
Yeah.
Certain stars, demonic stars, aligned for him over Venezuela for now. And it's just taught him all the wrong lessons. But getting back to the blockade, so apparently, according to the New York Times, there are, as they said, over a dozen U.S. Navy ships in the Gulf of Oman. So that's on the, you know, there's the Persian Gulf, then there's the tiny, you know, the constricted Strait of Hormuz.
A lot of coastline, and pretty empty, but.
Yeah, but that area, I mean, there are two explanations here. One is they are there, and the Iranians are just tracking it, but they don't want to fire because that 100% returns everything to full, you know, warfare, and they want to still see if they can get a strategic victory inked, you know, as it is now. You know, or that the term the Gulf of Oman is being very loosely interpreted by whoever's telling the New York Times that they're in the Gulf of Oman and they're actually way out in the Arabian Sea. Because during hostilities, the U.S. Navy would not get within 1,000 kilometers of any Iranian coastline. So they're way out in the Arabian Sea.
Yeah.
And so that would mean these 12-plus vessels, maybe it's all submarines. Yeah, I don't know what we're saying here. Like, these vessels would be, you know, in firing range of Iranian and Houthi anti-ship missiles and drones and so on. They'd be sitting ducks, basically.
Yeah.
So it's strange that...
Well,
let's
just face the fact that we're not being well served by our captive and craven press. That's one fact that is becoming pretty evident, that the old wartime consensus of the mainstream press that let's not give anything away that could help the enemy or much less threaten our contacts is in play again, and nobody's going to tell us.
Yeah, that is true. So what else here? There's a lot of diplomacy going on. There's supposed to be a second round of ceasefire talks, but the Iranians, I think, are refusing to enter a second round of talks until the Israelis stop slaughtering Lebanon. And I think that's why Trump people have leaked that the Israelis are going to announce a ceasefire by tonight, but this is before then, so we're just guessing. And then that will open the way for Iran to have a second round of talks with the Trump people. And in the meantime, just today, Field Marshal Asim Munir, Pakistan's military leader and Donald Trump's favorite field marshal, visited Tehran. I don't know if you saw some images, John, of the it's either F-4s or F-5s escorting the field marshal's plane into Tehran. Iran still has those old Phantoms. Yeah, they were pretty good planes. Iran had Phantoms, and then the F-14 Tomcat. Wasn't that the first Top Guns? Was it F-14s? I'm trying to remember that.
Yeah, I think it was, but... they ran out of parts and nobody would resupply them, which was not very sporting. But then the United States has never played a very sporting role in its wars with Iran.
But the F-14, I mean, it's one of those gold plate, you know, one of those kind of gold-plated planes and stuff. But it did perform pretty well against the Iraqis, at least. The Iranians were able to, I think they set aside some F-14s as basically just to be stripped for their spare parts, plus Israelis in the first couple of years of the war also kind of gave them know-how, spare parts, helped them design, helped them basically, supposedly anyway, helped them come up with ways to manufacture at least some of the spare parts, because the F-14 requires an enormous amount of upkeep and spare parts constantly.
Yeah, it was quite a radical plane. I mean, it depended on an air-to-air missile that had incredible range for the time and was self-guided for almost all that time. Like, it could fire and forget from 60 miles away, in theory. Yeah. And then you could just get your plane out of there, and the missile, in theory, would guide itself to the target.
Yeah, when the Iranians, and this was one of the things that shocked Saddam Hussein also, and had him trying to sue for peace within months, I mean, pretty quickly. Actually, even within weeks, he was already like thinking, how can I get out of this? And then finally the Iranians kicked him out of Iran completely, and he kept trying to sue for peace, and the Iranians said no. But it was their air power. They really, as I said, these pilots were not pro-IRI, and the IRI did not like the pilots, but they all worked together for nationalistic reasons. The F-14, but what they would do, the Iranians, to attack Iraq and blow up planes on the ground and blow up strategic targets all the way as far as the very far west of Iraq, was the F-14s would protect the tankers. They had some 707s as tankers, and they would fly with the F-4s and F-5s over Iran in ways that I guess avoided some of their surface-to-air missiles. And the F-14s were able to just basically smoke the MiGs, the Iraqi MiGs. And the F-4s and F-5s were able to destroy targets on the ground very successfully. And that went on for at least the first several years of the war. And the F-14s did perform pretty well then. But
Yeah, and the F-4 was always better as a ground attack plane, like setting the jungle on fire in Vietnam.
Right. Yeah, those infamous photos or videos of that. Yeah. So other diplomacy going on, I just want to mention here a few things. The presumptive, I guess you'd say, vice president is kind of how he's described, of the UAE. The UAE during this war has been, certainly of the Gulf states, by far the most annoying country. I don't know if you follow them on social media. Like at least when the Israelis are annoying, and they're incredibly annoying and grating and evil and all that, but they're sort of backing it up with, as they say, kinetic evil. Whereas the UAE is like the yapping, you know, the small dog yapping dog. We're going to destroy you. We're never going to let you get away with this. But they don't have any teeth behind it, really. And but their leader, MBZ, has been so steeped in military imperialism against weak states that it's been very hard for him, I think, to kind of adjust to this. But just in the last 24 hours, his brother, so MBZ's brother, Sheikh Mansour bin Zayed, he is known as Sheikh Mansour, had a phone call with the Speaker of Parliament in Iran, Mohammad Khalibaf, who's probably the best known face of the Iranian government these days. And that suggests that despite all of the screaming and everything, that even the UAE, not to mention, you know, the Saudis definitely, but even the UAE is looking at this and realizing that whatever happens, they at least have to really consider some way of diplomatically dealing with Iran and trying to come to some kind of understanding, because because the war that U.S. and Israel launched and Iran's response to it has caused enormous and very permanent damage to the UAE. But there's still a lot more damage that can be done. It's an extremely rich state. But really, it's been probably hurt more than any of the GCC states because its wealth was not just its oil and its petrochemicals industry, although, of course, that's the basis of it, but the way it transformed itself into this international, basically international offshore bank, tourist destination, influencer destination, a tax, you know, tax evader haven. Like, that's kind of gone now. It's not safe anymore unless their relations with Iran are on a better heel, and the U.S. and Israel can't protect them. So that's potentially, I think, a good thing if there's more diplomacy. And then one other thing also, I think there was another meeting. Pakistan, you know, they've sent, I think, some troops to Saudi Arabia. They're kind of deepening their ties. There's a wish-casting reaction to this from the kind of the Zionist Trumpoid crowd, which is, oh, that means Pakistan's going to go to war for Saudi Arabia against Iran. And that was one of the reasons we initially wanted to talk with Sabrina about Pakistan. That's never going to happen. This is really in reaction to Israel as a source of so much instability and damage to the region, and the U.S. as a declining and chaotic power and trying to figure out how you're going to survive, you know, in that reality. You can't rely on these states at all for keeping the peace. They're actually agents of chaos. So the Saudis, Turkey, Egypt, and Pakistan, again, are kind of recommitting or deepening these ties they're making. And this is really about the world, the kind of the post-US-Israel or certainly post-US world. Israel's always going to be a danger, I think, to that whole region, with or without the US.
With regard to the very fragile structure of Gulf states, like Dubai in particular, mm-hmm. I mean, Iran would only have to say one missile, floor 37, Burj Khalifa Tower. Yes. and that would quiet them down mm-hmm. in a big way.
Yeah. In the meantime, you know, just from what we've had, I mean, I feel like we haven't really felt the full energy effects of this war. And we're in Asia, they're feeling it. In Australia, and I don't know about New Zealand.
Very much.
Yeah. The diesel especially, right? And maybe the jet fuel.
And especially the South Island, because the South Island is kind of an afterthought in New Zealand policy. Everybody wants to make sure Auckland has enough, but they haven't stored much in the South Island.
Right. The IEA came out and said Europe has just 6 weeks of jet fuel left. I know that in Europe, including in Italy, they've been canceling some flights, but there's a real urgency. That's why it's just so bizarre that Trump is doing a blockade, because it's an energy shortage that we're looking at. It's not just sort of a price hike. Somehow they're kind of able to manipulate through various ways, probably through direct intervention, through announcements, the ups and downs. They're able to kind of manipulate the paper version of at least oil. But you can't fake if there's no actual physical crude in refineries to create jet fuel kerosene. And there isn't. So they're running, and diesel is, you know, drying up. Australia has a diesel problem. I think the U.S. is shipping some of its diesel out there. So, you know, I feel like it seems impossible to me that we're not going to be seeing even like rippling inflationary effects and maybe shortages that are going to carry on for months, because East Asia, which is being hit hardest by this, is the manufacturing heartland of the whole world economy. Everybody relies on it. And all of its energy inputs have either gone up or are running out. And so I feel like we're still have more pain there yet to see.
Oh, I'm sure. And yeah. In the long run, that might wake people up, but it just as well might not wake people up. It might just as well make them even more primitive and crazy than they are now.
That would be the lesson of having lived too long. That's kind of what happens.
Oh, I know. I'm really well aware of that.
Yeah.
And on that happy note.
Yes, on that happy note, we can end here. Thank you, everybody. Thanks, John Brendan, and all of our subscribers. And talk to you soon.
Thanks, everybody.
Bye.
Bye.